From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, journalist and author Alex Kotlowitz talks with us about his newest book on the impact of gun violence in Chicago.
Beats Me examines the impact of 1960s freeway construction on Milwaukee neighborhoods.
Then, it wasn't so long ago that many Americans were a meal or two away from starvation, which partly explains our embrace of processed and shelf-stable foods.
That ability to preserve food and then fortify it and inoculate it with antibacterials and vitamins, you know, make it more than what it actually is. When it first started, that really served a great purpose and helped people.
And writer James Anderson talks about what draws him to the people who inhabit his novels.
You know that game they used to have that if you say a word, a common word, but if you say it 100 times, it sounds strange? I think the same thing is true of people.
Lake Effect is next after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. When Alex Kotlowitz's book, There Are No Children Here, first came out in 1992, the country was facing unprecedented violence. Homicides in the nation's largest cities were at an all-time high, triggered by gangs and a drug trade that dominated many of the country's poorest neighborhoods. His book was set in the Henry Horner Homes, a public housing project on the west side of Chicago.
But much has changed over the last decades. The Henry Horner Homes, as well as many other public housing projects in Chicago, were torn down. The gangs that once ruled these areas were similarly demolished, as gang leaders were jailed with hefty sentences. Violence decreased, but it didn't vanish.
Kotlowitz's newest book is called An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. It tells 14 stories about loss, family, and survival in a city that continues to be racked by gun violence. Kotlowitz will be in Milwaukee this Wednesday for an event at Boswell Book Company, but he joined us by phone beforehand. Alex, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, I have to say, writing questions for this interview was really difficult. It's hard to find a place to begin, in part because I don't think anyone can read this book and not feel like these conversations are a little insufficient, right? Insufficient in some way. But I'd like to start here. Why did you write this book? Why right now?
In some ways, this book is kind of a bookend to my first book, There Are No Children Here, which came out some 28 years ago. And one of the things that knocked me off balance when I was working on that book was the just pervasiveness of the violence in the community I was writing about. You know, I was following two young boys in a public housing complex. And I have been really distressed and sobered by the stubborn persistence of the violence. And my feeling over the years is that we've completely underestimated the impact of the violence on the spirit of both individuals and the spirit of community. And that's what I wanted to try to get at in this book and these very intimate stories.
You know, one of the things the book talks about is PTSD. And it's one of those things that you go, it's not quite the right word because it's never post.
Right. You know, there's a conversation among social workers who work in these communities, and I certainly saw it in the people that I spent time with. You know, they have a lot of the same symptoms that combat veterans had returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, they're easy to anger, they have trouble concentrating, they're self-medicating by smoking marijuana or drinking, trouble sleeping, just anxious all the time. But as you suggest, while they have the same symptoms of those who've experienced post-traumatic stress disorder, there's nothing post about it because they experience the violence, they lose a loved one, they're a witness to an act of brutality, and yet there's no safety, there's no place of respite. They are still looking over their shoulder for what's going to happen next. And so social workers have this informal term in these communities, it's what they call complex loss, the idea that you may lose someone close to you, but then have to reckon with what lies ahead.
There's so many different coping mechanisms that are on display in this book, and I'd like to get back to that, but to kind of go back in Chicago's history, because we tend to talk about violence in Chicago as though it's still kind of the 1990s, as though it has these mechanisms that are in some ways no longer there. So mm-hmm. how have things changed in Chicago since you wrote There Are No Children Here?
Sure. Well, the two most notable things that have changed is as bad as the violence is now, and it is really bad, it was actually worse some 28 years ago. Though I will say the numbers in the past couple of years have approached the numbers of the 1990s again, which has been really disturbing and unsettling. But the other part that's changed considerably is back in the early 90s, the gangs were organized around the drug trade. And so the violence was much more directed. It was usually over controlling their turf or their terrain. And in the late 1990s, the law enforcement agencies went after the heads of the snake. They went and arrested many of the gang leaders in the city, and as a result, the gangs began to fall apart. And now, you know, the police estimate there are now 600 to 800 different cliques or crews around the city, organized block by block. They're not organized around the drug trade. The violence feels more arbitrary. It feels more petty, that somebody's been disrespected in some manner, and it feels much more unpredictable.
You mentioned cliques, of course, and in the book you speak with someone who was the head of a gang in Chicago, and something that he talks about is exactly what you mentioned, how arbitrary the violence has become. When you're talking about these cliques, it seems as though everyone in the book is part of something, that it's kind of unavoidable.
Well, it's hard if you're young, especially a young man growing up in these communities, just by the nature of where you live, not to belong to one of these organizations. And I think one of the things that was clear to me, and you see it in some of the stories in the book, is that often when the newspapers or the police report on an act of violence, the first thing that they describe about the victim is the fact that they were a gang member, as if that somehow is what defines them. And as a result, people, loved ones, are, you know, their immediate stance in the wake of losing someone is to defend them, because there's this kind of notion out there, I think, that what goes around comes around.
One of the things the book really does is it does humanize people. You know, you read headlines, especially if you're in the city of Chicago or if you're in a city like Milwaukee, honestly, and it is very matter of fact. This person was shot. It was at this corner, and this is their criminal record. But there is so much more to that person. And the interesting part of it is, of your book, is that you not only humanize the victims, but you also humanize the perpetrators.
What I wanted to do in this book, I was looking for, you know, the book is, it takes place over the course of this one summer. It's a collection of 14 stories. Some of them course through the summer, some are self-contained. And I was looking for stories that upended my thinking, that challenged my own sort of presuppositions and assumptions. And what I wanted to write, I wanted, you know, the kind of centripetal force of storytelling is empathy, this idea of trying to imagine yourself as others. And I wanted to try to write this book without judging, but really trying to understand. So the stories really vary. And as you mentioned, one of the stories is about a gentleman who, at the age of 18, in an act of vengeance, one of his friends has been shot and paralyzed, goes out and kills a rival gang member, and he ends up serving 14 years in prison. And Eddie Bocanegra, his story is really a story about trying to forgive yourself for what you've done. And Eddie, as an adult, has devoted every minute of his life to trying to undo some of the damage that he help cause when he was younger. He's, you know, working in violence prevention. He's mentoring young people. I mean, just an extraordinary individual. But the story itself is Eddie's still trying to find a way to forgive himself for what he had done.
One of the stories that stuck out to me was the mother of a man who was shot by another man in a situation that it seemed like no one really came in with good mm-hmm. intentions.
Right.
And it really highlighted how people can end up really on either side of that
right.
equation.
Right. No, the lines are often blurred. I mean, the story you talk about is a story of this extraordinary woman, Lisa Daniels, a single mom. Her older son is an engineering student at University of Illinois, and her younger son, Darren, he wanders, he strays, he gets involved in dealing drugs. Lisa does everything she can to hold him close. And then one day he goes to buy some drugs, a small amount of marijuana. It appears that he had all intentions of robbing the drug dealer, and that the drug dealer may have had all intentions of robbing him. And a shootout erupts, and Darren is killed. And so two things happen. One is that the local newspaper runs a story about Darren's death, and all it talks about is his criminal record. He had spent some time in prison. And Lisa, his mother, she wasn't in denial. She knew exactly her son's history. She knew what her son had done, but she knew there was so much more to Darren. And so she made it a point to letting people know that her son was a much richer, complicated human being than the authorities would lead you to believe. And in fact, she got on her license plate, on the frame of her license plate, it reads, "I had a son, his name was Darren." But the other remarkable thing about Lisa is, you know, she assumes that the person who killed him is going to go to away prison for a long time. It seems like a kind of open and shut case. But as it turns out, the witness to the shooting had a criminal record and made for a suspect witness. And so the state's attorney decides that they want to offer a plea deal. And Lisa says, okay, but I have one request, and I want to give a victim impact statement at the sentencing. And usually victim impact statements are about the impact the death of the loved one has had on you and your family. And so Lisa gets up in the courtroom and she talks a little bit about that. But then she gives this remarkable talk where she asks for leniency, where she forgives the person who shot her son. And in fact, to this day, she's got a correspondence with the young man who's now serving time in prison.
Her story is so remarkable, I think, in part because many of us, although we want to believe we would be like her, I think many of us know that maybe we couldn't.
It is really hard, and I think, to be fair, and I really want to be careful about this, and Lisa knows this, is that there are instances where forgiveness is really, really hard, if not impossible, when there's no sense of remorse on the part of the individual who had done the shooting. But go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, no problem. But one of the things I was about to ask is there are a lot of different coping mechanisms, but also just responses to the violence that people mm-hmm. see, that they experience. What are some of the ways that people deal with this onslaught of violence?
You know, the thing for me that was notable among most of the people I spent time with is they hold on to their feelings and their experiences really tightly. Not only are they not encouraged from talking about it, but sometimes discouraged out of fear that if they do, they'll be held culpable for the crime. And so for many of the people I spent time with, it was the first time they spoke about their loss, about what they were going through. I mean, there's this kind of utter sense of loneliness. And that, you know, that grief, that trauma can take a toll on individuals. You know, people look for solace in all different manners and ways. You know, many of the mothers who grieve in Chicago, they form support groups amongst each other. After a shooting in the city, the shrines arise, you know, flowers and balloons, you know, and in the summer, they're kind of, you can find them virtually everywhere. So people have all these different ways of managing. And I think, you know, the truth of the matter is, I think by telling stories is what, there's a great line in Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, where he writes, you know, it's this novel about, loosely based on his experience in Vietnam, where he writes, you know, this much is true, stories can save us. And I think what O'Brien was saying is that if we can tell our stories, if we can share our stories, that's what ultimately will connect us, will make us feel less alone.
Well, and with that thought, you know, these stories are in some ways very uniquely Chicago. But you didn't title the book A Chicago Summer, you titled it An American Summer. And of course, these stories are very familiar here in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the elements of these stories that are right. universal and really speak to the violence that we're seeing throughout the country?
Right. Well, I titled it that way for two reasons. One is that, you know, you're right. The book takes place in Chicago. It just as easily could have taken place in in Milwaukee and in Detroit and Philadelphia, Baltimore. I mean, there's so many cities that are experiencing this. But moreover, you know, we're a city that has, a country that's been racked by gun violence. And what's notable to me is that in the wake of the tragic shootings in Newtown and then Parkland, we asked all the right questions. You know, well, what brought this young man to do what he did? How do these individuals in this community emerge with all that's bearing down on them? We don't ask those questions in places like Chicago or Milwaukee or Detroit or Baltimore. And we need to start asking those questions.
What do you hope people take away from this book? People who might not know anything about the city of Chicago, who may have a lot of misconceptions about what gun violence looks like.
Yeah. And again, I don't see this book as a book about Chicago. I feel like it's really a book about the kind of soul of our country. And what I want people to come to understand is that in some ways, the book is a kind of rallying cry that we need to begin really sort of figuring out what we can do. And I think the one commonality you'll see in all the neighborhoods in Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, Baltimore, where the violence is so pervasive, is that these are communities that are deeply distressed. And in some ways, this seems so self-evident, I even hesitate to say it aloud, but we need to find ways to rebuild and refortify community. And so given how self-evident it is, the question I ask is, where's everyone been? You know, for me, I tell stories, my ambitions are reasonably modest, is I tell stories to introduce readers to communities they otherwise wouldn't venture to introduce them to people they otherwise wouldn't meet. And my hope is that when you put down this book, that you'll look at yourself and the world just a little bit differently.
I think that's a very modest hope there, and something that I don't think anyone could pick up this book and not think differently.
Well, thanks. Thanks.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alex Kotlowitz is a journalist and the author of An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. He'll join Lake Effect's Joy Powers in conversation Wednesday night at Boswell Book Company, and there's more information at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then we'll have the latest edition of our Beats Me series. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. As highway routes were constructed in the 1960s, many Milwaukeeans were impacted. Houses were demolished, businesses were forced to relocate. In part due to the upheaval, some communities still haven't recovered decades later.
WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell examines this subject in the latest installment of our Beats Me series.
One of our listeners says she's heard stories about a freeway spur running through Milwaukee's Central City in the 1960s, impacting what she says were vibrant neighborhoods at the time. She wanted to know more. So I looked into how the freeway construction conversation started. I met with the curator and operations manager at the Milwaukee County Historical Society. Ben Barbera says talks about a freeway system began as early as the 1920s.
As automobiles were becoming more popular, they realized that the street system wasn't designed for automobile traffic, and there was a lot of gridlock and other issues happening as more and more people were driving. But it wasn't until the 1940s that the city really started to begin planning for an expressway system.
Barbera says additional factors contributed to the freeway plan. There was a post-World War II economic boom as soldiers returned home. Some people moved to the suburbs, but still needed to get downtown to their jobs. Planning and construction got underway, and most of the major freeway construction was completed in the 1960s. Barbera says the freeway routes we drive today reflect the vision that leaders had years ago.
So you've got the north-south and then east-west routes of 94 and 894. Those were the ones that they've identified primarily, and then north-south route is now 43 running up to the northern areas.
It's the I-43 route that runs through Central City neighborhoods, which were at the time, and still are, predominantly African American.
Roughly between 1960 and 1969, roughly 17,000 homes were dislocated, for lack of a better term, eradicated. Business numbers are a little bit harder to pin down, but it could be as many as 1,000 businesses were affected. And these were everything from, you know, a small barbershop up to some medium-sized manufacturing plants that were in the area.
The freeway did not run through Bronzeville, then the city's premier African-American business and entertainment district. However, the nearby construction did impact the district. It wasn't just African-Americans who felt the effects of the I-43 project. But Barbera says they were disproportionately affected compared to the German, Jewish, and white residents who had lived in the area. Andre Lee Ellis was a child at the time and remembers the neighborhoods changing.
And my parents were very much so ones that would talk with us about what was going on in the world, in life. I could tell that there was something not good about it.
Ellis's family was living in the Lapham Projects on 6th and Brown during that time. He says at first people were excited by the thought of the new expressway and what it would do to ease congestion. But soon they noticed the consequences of the road construction.
It was more where, you know, you could intentionally see that they were interrupting the progress of Black people. Black people were making progress. Businesses were there. And all of that was interrupted when the expressways came.
Ellis says the expressway disconnected Black people by running right through neighborhoods and slicing east-west streets in half. He says that harmed commercial business, sending consumers elsewhere. Ellis says he remembers how that made him feel.
I remember thinking this is the first time that I realized the word poor and how poor people were treated. Poor, we poor. That's how they do poor people. You know, that's how they do us. That's what I kept hearing.
As more and more people started to see the downside of the freeway construction, they pushed back at plans for additional stretches. Claiborne Benson, executive director of the Wisconsin Black Historical Society, says Black people began to picket, and other communities responded as well.
The white citizens in the Wauwatosa area saw all of the demolition and the construction going on, said, stop, no more. And they put pressure on the system to say, we will not be forwarding through with this project.
Construction on other freeway projects stopped completely in the early 70s. Today, we still drive on roads that were meant to be connected to the freeway. And you can still find maps that show the much more extensive freeway system that planners originally had in mind. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by The Doman Company.
Taryn Powell is WUWM's Race and Ethnicity Reporter. If you have a question for her or one of our other beat reporters, you can submit your Beats Me question at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now, and then Milwaukee writer Christina Ward gives us a history of 20th century America through our food. Lake Effect continues with that in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Have you ever wondered why such a thing as a gingered pear and chicken salad served in lime jello exists? Well, what about baked bananas rolled in ham and served with a cheese sauce? Or anything at all made with Spam or even just Spam itself?
The foods and recipes many of us grew up with were thanks to American corporations and their advertising departments. Not only were the corporations promoting the products they were selling, they were also promoting what it meant to be an American.
Christina Ward's newest book, American Advertising Cookbooks, looks at how things like Jell-O, bananas, and Spam became household staples, and it's a fascinating story. She joined me in the studio back in February and explained that this book came out of her first one, Preservation, the Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration.
In doing all my research about the history of food preservation, it became really, really clear that food preservation in and of itself was such a cataclysmic event in culinary history. And then when you look, start peeling that back and looking closer, the ability to keep food longer than a few days changed how we're going to eat, because then it enabled just your small farmer to have a few more days, and then he could take it to market. And then those market folks then became processors, as they would make things out of it. And then it just, the business expanded. I mean, if you think about Hellman's mayonnaise was started by Richard Hellman in, I think, 1910. And he owned a small deli in New York City. And he and his wife made their recipe mayonnaise in the back of the shop and sold it out of the shop. And because of the technology of being able to preserve things and then start marketing and the distribution, within 3-4 years, he was nationwide.
And you think, yes, we are a business-oriented culture. You know, Americans are very good about the bootstrap thing and the entrepreneur thing and making stuff to sell. Corporations somehow took over.
They did. And it, I think that there's a myth that this rise of corporations is, you know, something of a recent of memory. It's not. So even with the example of Hellman's, they started, and by the 1920s, in the span of 10 years, they were bought out by another company that eventually became General Foods. So,
although they kept the name Hellman's.
They did keep the Hellman's as a brand, and that's one of the, I think, the things that's really interesting is that a lot of the foods that we're familiar with today that we think are just freestanding things are just brand names, and they're owned by a larger corporate entity. And that's started right in the 1910s. This is coming out of the kind of that gilded age of the corporate robber barons. And so there was almost like an American mania for building the biggest company you possibly could. And the laws at the time kind of helped that along. What we think of as like some of the anti-monopoly laws didn't really come in until after the 1920s. And since they were enacted in the 20s, they've been kind of peeled back, you know, a little bit at a time until now, where, again, we're in a position where a lot of what they call holding companies are owning a diversified portfolio of actual companies. So you've got food manufacturers that are also cigarette manufacturers and sellers. And so it's a interesting food landscape.
Well, and as you say, it started 100 years ago, really,
it
in
did,
this country.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it seems to me that we have somehow maybe tried to reverse that a little bit in the last decade or so, where, you know, we're interested in going to farmers markets and buying somebody's local preserves, or we're interested in finding out who actually owns the companies that produce the food that we eat.
And I think it's the arc. I'm a fan of pure science, but I'm also cautious about applied science, because sometimes the applied sciences are applied by corporations, and that's the unintended consequences. And I think we have to remember culturally, we're not too far away from actual starvation, where people did starve, where, you know, if you didn't know where your next meal was coming from for the next few days, you were really in trouble. And so that ability to preserve food and then fortify it and inoculate it with antibacterials and vitamins and, you know, make it more than what it actually is. When it first started in the 20s and 30s and 40s, it really served a great purpose and helped people. But the unintended consequences, of course, are the increased amounts of salts and sugars that have added to the obesity crisis in the United States. So that helped trigger that kind of the consciousness about, like, what are we really eating here? And do we really want to eat this?
Did it also affect the idea of sort of corporate agriculture, where we have monocrops because we have to support the kind of processing that you're describing here?
Absolutely. That's the story of bananas. Bananas are a monocrop. They are asexual reproducers, which means, like a tuber, like when you're planting tulips, you have to put the thing in the ground to get the thing to fruit. And by doing that with one variety over time through Central America, that decimated the local kind of flora and agriculture systems. Not to mention, because something like a banana, which has really only a few natural predators and doesn't really evolve in its DNA, is very susceptible to things like a root rot or a leaf rot. And so Central America itself has been poisoned over the past 70 years by pesticides. And so, again, it's unintended consequences. We want bananas. We like bananas. But now bananas are actually on the verge of extinction because the predatory viruses and blights that have been evolving to eat those bananas are winning. So right now, and again, this is kind of the interesting thing with the science of bananas, and it's happening, as you said, with a lot of other crops too, is how do we protect from vermin and with pesticides? And so that next phase is now you're seeing a lot of what they call genetically modified, where much of the wheat crop and corn crops and soy crops in the United States are actually modified that have the pesticide adjusted in the actual seed. And so the plant itself is resistant to any type of blight.
So how did we learn to love Spam, which is one of the things you mentioned?
The story of Spam is so interesting. Again, it comes out of food preservation. In 1906, there was a law finally passed called the Food and Drug Act. And it was the first time in the United States that we had any kind of national rules about what actually was food. And it actually published a book called The Formulary, and it defined every kind of food and what was in it, what it could contain. And before that, there were a lot of food scares, contaminated foods and things passed off as food that wasn't. And so the idea of a spam, which is a pork byproduct, mostly fat with a lot of salt, prior to the development in World War I, would have never passed muster with the United States because the consumer was afraid of any kind of adulterated foods. But through really good marketing, which was the idea of saying, this is for the country, this is healthy, it's fortified, it's got vitamins, it's inexpensive, and so you should eat it. You know, you're doing your part for the war efforts by giving it to your friends and family. And so it was also served as a military ration. And so post-World War II then, as many soldiers came home, they developed a taste for that salty, porky fat, which, you know, fry it up. It's kind of delicious in a terrible way. And so the marketing then changed to say, you know, reward your hardworking men with, you know, Spam. And that's really how they taught us to love that taste.
Well, and it sounds like it's both, and I hesitate to use the word collusion because maybe that's too strong a word for it, but between corporations and the government, if it's like for the war effort.
Oh, there's collusion.
Okay, so it's not too strong a word.
Oh, it is not too strong a word at all, because one of the pioneers of food advertising was Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays, who's the nephew of Sigmund Freud, who was trained in the early psychoanalytic techniques and understanding of human psychology, his first job before he went into advertising was working for the Committee for the Public Interest, which was a precursor to the CIA and was in charge of propaganda during World War I and up until the early 1930s. So there's a definite relationship between governments and advertising and corporations. Funnily enough, I mean, it comes to his partners he was working with at the CPI were the Dulles brothers, the infamous Dulles brothers, who one headed up the CIA and then one worked for John Kennedy.
And had an airport named after him.
And has an airport named after him. So again, and this also, I think, tells the story of, it's a smallness. And I think, you know, part of that, we forget. We think we're a big country, but we find it here in Milwaukee, kind of that joke of small walkie. When you're working in the elite, the corporations, we're looking at some of the early founding families, everybody knew everybody. So it wasn't necessarily a malicious collusion, but it was a friendly collusion of like, this is the guy you went to Harvard with. This is the guy you served in the early propaganda outfit with. And they all helped each other.
Before we turn on the microphones, we were talking about how this is about way more than food. It's about culture and defining culture and what is acceptable and what isn't through the advertising, through the kind of foods that you were told to eat or encouraged to eat. And, you know, it had even involved gender norms.
Absolutely. And this is where I think I wanted to tell this story. Because it was that one time that I could pinpoint in the kind of American history of when we really became Americans. And it was that idea of the communications. Printing presses became cheap. The food became cheaper. Travel, railroads opened up the country to the expansion. Immigrants coming in. So we had all these different influences and then people trying to control those outcomes and then having the tools to do it. So when you talk about like the idea of food from our early Puritan founders, they had very distinct ideas about what food was proper. I mean, if you're looking at early Protestant food cookbooks, there's no spices for a number of reasons. And that through line, through again, through those families and through those generations, the traditions held true. So, you know, we're still in the 1930s and 40s and covering everything in white sauce, which is, you know, not a bechamel. It's just flour and a little milk. It's not really, it's more like paste. But the idea was, is to keep everything packed full of calories because you needed it if you're going to work in a factory or a farm. And keep everybody eating in a very similar way because you didn't want things that would be too exciting or too outside what the norm was. And so that's where you get like the great Born in Milwaukee, the Settlement Cookbook, which was founded by earlier settler German Jews. And as that second wave of Jewish immigration came to Milwaukee, which were mostly Eastern European and Ashkenazi Jews, who had a totally different type of outlook on food and cooking. And, you know, the high-born, very elite German Jews wanted to teach the newcomers, this is how you're American. You cook like us. And that became like a real through line through a lot of the immigrant groups had different settlement houses that were usually funded by the wives of the manufacturer factory owners here in Milwaukee. And they each had a way to help teach the kids, teach everybody, again, how to be American. And being American meant being more Protestant, more conservative, and, you know, less fun, really.
Where do you see this kind of influence happening now? Do we have the same sort of need to look to corporations to tell us how to eat like an American?
I think we're more savvy to advertisers, but we're not immune. I think where you see a lot of it more is with cooking shows. And, you know, this is just a theory because of how we, you know, ate a lot of boxed canned foods growing up for a certain period of time, is that a lot of our food marketing is aspirational. And so what you'll see a lot of is the food, the kits, I think, are really an interesting phenomenon. So when you see those pre-made food kits, or you can order online, or they have delivered, it's essentially buying food in a box. The same thing it was, you know, 50 years ago. But they've kind of zhuzhed up the marketing, and you see happy people with their families and the time. And it has this really wonderful aspirational aspect to it. And I think that's where the marketing is going right now. And I think we should also be cautious of it because the negative connotations, again, are describing who gets to be an American. So you see these like beautiful, thin people making their dinners, and they're all in these very upper middle class houses. And so we have to be really careful, again, about the messages of class and gender and, you know, how we judge people who are eating what kind of food.
Milwaukee author Christina Ward's newest book is American Advertising Cookbooks, How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O.
Our interview with her first aired in February. We will take one last break and then visit with writer James Anderson, who brings us another atmospheric novel of the American Southwest. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. For a setting that is often bright and wide open, writer James Anderson manages to find some dark places. Anderson's first novel, The Never Open Desert Diner, told an intriguing but dark tale featuring a Utah truck driver named Ben Jones.
Anderson's follow-up features Jones as well and some of the other mysterious and lonely characters from his first book. Lullaby Road is no less atmospheric and no less intriguing than Anderson's previous effort. He joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke back in November and began the interview by reading the first page and a half of the novel.
A momentary silence was all that marked the passing of summer into winter. After living most of my almost 40 years in the high desert of Utah, 20 driving a truck, I had come to the conclusion there were really only two seasons, hot and windy and cold and windy. Everything else was just a variation on those two. Late in the evening, I lay half awake in my single bed and knew the silence meant the season had changed. I like to think maybe I know a thing or two about silence. Real silence is more than the absence of sound. It is something you feel. A few heartbeats earlier, a steady wind scattered the leftover sounds from the evening, a car passing, neighbors talking from behind closed doors, somewhere a dog barking, all the usual muffled racket of nearby lives. Then there was nothing. Nothing at all. As if the desert and everyone in it had vanished and left nothing behind but an indifferent starless light. By 4 a.m., when I begin my workday, winter was on its hind legs and waiting. It took longer than usual to get to the transfer station and load my truck. The time was well after 5 o'clock when I finally got underway, driving cautiously through the light snow and ice in the pre-dawn darkness. My heater was blowing full blast and the bitter, dry cold hijacked the warmth through my body and cracked my skin into something akin to a hard pan lake bed. My last routine stop was to take on diesel. I had missed the morning fueling rush, if there had been one, by being either a few minutes early or a few minutes late. All of the pump islands were empty. Cecil Boone was the manager of the Stop and Gone truck stop on US 191 just outside of Price, Utah. The Stop and Gone was a cheapo independent, stuck out alone in a patch of sand and broken rock, with the rundown look of a place that must have low prices because it didn't have much of anything else. Cecil was a stubby, sour man in his 50s. We were inside the small convenience store, and Cecil was behind the register. In the 8 or so years I had been buying my diesel there, nearly every weekday, I had never seen the man smile before that snowy October morning. There are probably a lot of reasons to smile. Most folks do it every day. In my line of work, I don't see many smiles, and I probably don't give many. Not even to myself. That was the way it should be. No one wants to glance up and see a truck driver grinning. My sense is that such a sight is bound to have an unsettling effect on the ordinary driver. I was quickly sorting through the reasons people smile, humor, warmth, trivial annoyance, and coming up short. It was just Cecil and me and Cecil's smile.
That's James Anderson reading the opening to Lullaby Road. First of all, thank you very much.
Thank
well
you.
Well read. And I wasn't going to start here, but the observation right at the end of that is something I never stopped to think of before. You never do see truck drivers smiling because it would be unsettling.
Yes. In fact, a few people have mentioned that to me. Of course, you'd have to be able to look up in a way and actually see them. But if you could, I think there's a certain there's a lot in the mythology of truck drivers, starting with Thelma and Louise and Steven Spielberg's first one.
Right, the one about the truck.
Yeah, the Phantom truck. So you start thinking, since you're down in a smaller car or whatever, that you've just been lowered on the food chain and something bad's going to happen.
There's a lot of bad that happens in the pages of this latest novel. But the thing that amazes me about your writing is we learn a lot about the setting. We learn plenty about Ben's way of thinking just from these first, I don't know, 6-7 paragraphs of the novel. You must put a lot of stock in your first chapter.
I do. And I was going to try and make it somehow punchier and more interesting. And so I wrote something else. I'd written that, and I wrote something else, and I had a chance to run it by Andre Debuse III and Laura Lippman and so on, but they didn't know who wrote it. And I think I set a record at the writers' conference I was at. As soon as they disliked something, they raised their hands. And on my previous opening that I'd written, they all put their hands up after about the third word. And so the thing is that the late David Bowie used to say, don't play to the stands. Do what you feel. And I decided, if I'm going to write something that's not good, I'm going to do it on my own terms. And one of the most rewarding things about writing The Never Open Desert Diner and now this one is originally I thought, well, the literary fiction people are going to hate it and the mystery people are going to hate it. As it turned out, both liked it. So I write what I feel and experience and I try to be true to that because I often read things out loud to myself because they tend to be, they lend themselves to voice. And truck drivers I know have told me that they listen to it on Audible, you know. So it's knowing that you're telling a good yarn, that you're telling a good story. But I pay a lot of attention to writing because, as you know, I know a lot of poets. I read a lot of poetry, and I'm very much in tune to the musicality of language.
It's interesting. The paperback edition of the book actually includes an excerpt from your first novel at the end of this one, which means, I suppose, that people who are coming into this with this novel might look at the previous one as a prequel.
Mm-hmm.
But for people who missed the Never Open Desert Diner, give us a thumbnail sketch of our hero. What's Ben Jones's story?
Well, Ben Jones, as far as he knows, is a Native American Jewish. The way the story goes on the reservation is that his mother was a Jewish social worker and his father was a Native American at the Warm Springs Reservation in Oregon. But he doesn't know. He was abandoned at the little reservation medical clinic. And he spends some time at the Indian school before he's adopted by a Mormon, an older childless Mormon couple in Utah. So in a lot of ways, he's like the ultimate exile who then becomes a truck driver serving the ultimate exiles, which even though he wouldn't admit it, are kind of his family. They're oddballs. They're eccentrics. They're all orphans, at least spiritually. You know, they're orphans.
Well, and it really raises the question of whether if you add a group of people who by fate or by choice are kind of loners or are off the grid, do you create a de facto community?
I think you do. It's a community of exiles. And in fact, in the Never Open Desert Diner, Ben observes that the only thing that they have in common is that they don't want to have anything in common. But they also realize, and this is restated again or emphasized in Lullaby Road, that they know that they're connected, that they have to depend on each other. And that's one of the themes of the book. Paradox, certainly, but the idea that when you're in such a harsh environment, whatever your political ideology is, that melts away because character is all about who you are when no one's looking. And if somebody turns their back on you, it means that you start that chain of events where people start turning their backs on one another. So people rely on each other in a very kind of strange, detached way.
What draws you to these kinds of lives?
You know, this particular book, Lullaby Road, is about children at risk. I was a child at risk. My mother and sister and I was 2 and a half. My sister was an infant. Our father abandoned us at a Greyhound bus station. And eventually a Quaker couple took us in and gave us a place to live and helped my mom get a job and so on. I've been asked, I was at this great big fan convention called BoucherCon, which was in St. Petersburg, and I was asked the question about how much research I do. And of course, everybody, you know, saying, well, I do this, I do that. And I said, you know, not a lot. These are my people. I worked on crews of men, you know, commercial fishing and logging and masonry. And so everybody, it's like, you know, that game they used to have that if you say a word, a common word, but if you say it 100 times, it sounds strange. I think the same thing is true of people. And Ben even says that in his book. No matter how well you know somebody, there's always a stranger inside them you don't. So these are people who are scared and sometimes desperate, but are most of them essentially good people, and they work hard. And, you know, not to beat this too hard, but that's the thing about Ben Jones. An agent one time when I was trying to sell my first book said, well, what's his superpower? You know, and I knew what the agent was asking for, and I didn't have an answer because Ben's an ordinary guy. But what Ben's superpower is a superpower of the ordinary guy who gets up every day, or woman, gets up every day, puts their shoes to the floor, and goes to work. There are no parades. You know, they're not a Nobel-winning physicist who is a former nun who, you know, the kinds of superpowers. And for me, that's heroic. That's courageous. No parades, no thank you, small paycheck.
Oregon writer James Anderson is the author of Lullaby Road. Our interview with him first aired last November. You can listen back to his previous interview about the Never Open Desert Diner at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.